This is Truth versus News on November 26th, one month before Christmas. And what a year it's been so far, and all kinds of things are happening. And if you didn't see the last part of the first hour, this is the second hour. You should go back before Chris Weinert gives a summation of what really is going on there. He's got quite an analysis coming up. Go for it, Chris.
Wow. I just want to make some relations between Netanyahu, his brother, and a lot of the Israeli terror attempts that they fought. Autopilot hijacking with the Boeing uninterruptible autopilot feature that was, you know, backdoored and gamed by the Israeli intelligence services and used to basically, I think, to really put these type of theatrics onto a lot of people that were on these flights to make it look like they were foiling some Black September hijacking attempts. And of course, very similar to 9/11, where these guys are intelligence assets groomed by either Mossad, CIA, or whatever alphabet agencies, School of Americas. And then these guys are hijacking planes, supposedly. And then the Israeli intelligence services, Netanyahu's brother, Jonathan, who died in Entebbe, supposedly, was a guy that was foiling these things. And, it caused a lot of turmoil with a lot of the 1% guys, too. Like Von Bulow got into some shit. Because he owned Lufthansa at the time, and he did not want to put these override systems into his planes for this very reason. And then next thing you know, he was framed for his wife's insulin overdose. And of course, the lawyer was Dershowitz in this. Jim Cramer was his research assistant. So there's a lot of guys that made their bones on this case, and many people don't really give this any sort of insight or further study. I just want to point this out to people so maybe they can start looking into this and realize that in 1979, Netanyahu led a conference in Tel Aviv about basically creating the Muslim terrorist to replace the communist threat that had been, you know, the precursors for much of the Cold War. And of course, if you remember in the 40s and 50s, you know, they had all the Red Scare and the espionage things and all this intellectual property that comes out from Israeli spies goes to Israel. And there's no repercussions whatsoever. And I think JFK in his murder was could have even been involved with much of the nuclear stuff that they got at Dimona and failing to submit to UN inspections, things like that. So in my opinion, I think that this group has been trying to create this terror system for a long, long time. You know, B'nai B'rith was another thing mentioned there earlier. The Knights of the Golden Circle, they were literally trying to take out much of Central and Southern America for their own control mechanisms, and it failed in the Civil War. So these guys have a long history. These are the guys that put in the Arab Royals in the early 19th century, the guys that ran, you know, the Young Turks and the purges in Turkey and in Azerbaijan. A lot of these Rothschild oil fields that came out of here in the 1905 conflicts were precursors to World War One, and it never gets mentioned there. So I think these guys really created a different type of proxy warfare from the traditional empirical notions. And I think that in World War One, that was the end of the empires and the introduction of this corporation type of takeover for resource management and control. And I think that these terror actions are very much part of this. It's very much used to bring the justification for the authorities to regulate, to be authorities, to do what they do. And in many cases, it's not really the pursuit of justice. It's more or less serving as cover fire for these resource thefts and extractions. And in a result of World War One, post-war, there was the, like I said, the red versus the white terrors. And then, of course, leading into the 30s, there was the communist versus socialist conflicts that were precursors for much of the pre-World War II and even post-World War II things. And the intelligence services ran Gladio B in Europe. They basically kept the European nations occupied with military force and used this Cold War pretense as a means, I think, to really control the trade and the resource extraction on both the Russian and the American side. And using the intelligence theater that they had with the communist Red Scares and witch hunt type tactics, I think as a loyalty test and as a way to snuff out any idealist from either side and really to send them to their own destruction. So I think what we know is our history, and what we saw from our media, it really needs to be revisited. And when you look at it as, like, say, the Rockefellers and Rothschilds running both sides of the banking systems and the resource control and both sides of the Cold War, you really can start to put together maybe what's going on, and especially seeing the War of Terror and how many of the creations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and much of the stuff in Boko Haram in Africa were intelligence creations and used to destabilize so that they can bring in the order and the stability. So I really think that this is a bargaining tactic, and it needs to be exposed. And I think that this is one of the many ways that these guys have been behind this. And Netanyahu, through Boston Consulting and through his terror convention in 79 in Tel Aviv, was very much an instrumental figure in bringing in much of what we've seen leading into 9/11 and even post 9/11 especially. So I'll let you guys maybe comment a little further on some of these things. I just wanted to put this on the spectrum of awareness for some of our listeners so that maybe they can do their own research and arrive at similar conclusions.
Very nice, mm-hmm. Chris, very nice.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, 9/11 families discussed it by social media app. On Friday, a group representing families affected by 9/11 expressed strong criticism toward TikTok for allowing the circulation of a letter by Osama bin Laden. The National Chair of 9/11 Families United emphasized the importance of recognizing bin Laden as a terrorist responsible for orchestrating the attacks, which resulted in the death of nearly 3,000 Americans. He highlighted the profound impact of the tragedy, expressing dismay at the apparent sympathy of younger Americans toward bin Laden's extremist and anti-Semitic views. 9/11 Families United, a coalition comprising families and survivors of the 9/11 attacks, has voiced its concern over the resurgence of bin Laden's letter to America, written in 2002, which sought to justify targeting and killing of American civilians. It has gained attention online, some videos on TikTok, showing support for his perspective and encouraging others to read the letter, particularly in the context of U.S. support for Israel in its conflict with Hamas. TikTok stated that promotion of content related to the letter violates its policy against supporting terrorism. The platform is actively working to remove such content. TikTok clarified the number of videos endorsing bin Laden views is relatively small, though some have attracted significant attention. Bin Laden, the leader behind the extremist views and architect of the 9/11 attacks, was killed in 2011 by special forces, which marked a significant moment in the global fight against terrorism, except it's a fantasy. It didn't happen. He was already dead. Meanwhile, mm-hmm. the Zero Dark 30, the deeper, darker truths, gives us a more accurate explanation of what's going on here. A film that might even take Academy Award for Best Picture in 2012 raises serious moral issues, glorifies a political stunt, and is based on an historical fiction. It is the latest in Obama propaganda. Osama bin Laden was not killed until May 2011 during the raid on a compound in Pakistan. He actually died in Afghanistan on or about 15 December 2001, and he was buried there in an unmarked grave. Local obituaries reported his death at the time. Even Fox and CNN subsequently confirmed it. He was buried in an unmarked grave, and according with Muslim tradition, he did not die in Pakistan. Nick Holerstrom has published about it. Osama bin Laden, 1957 to 2001. David Ray Griffin has a book about it. Osama bin Laden, Dead or Alive. And Scholars for 9/11 Truth has written about it. Even more importantly, the political context has been all but lost to history. Obama was on the hot seat for an apparently fake birth certificate, having tripped in Pakistan and not closing Guantanamo. By alleging that Tim had come from a prisoner held there and using troop station in Pakistan in a brilliant political stroke, He took his birth certificate off the front page, positioning himself for re-election. Osama was our man in Afghanistan. During the uprising and its occupation by Soviet forces, he was instrumental in securing Stinger missiles used to shoot down their helicopters and planes. In an earlier film about Afghanistan, Charlie Wilson's War, Osama's role was conveniently omitted. It would have been embarrassing to have acknowledged the man behind 9/11 had been working for us. When most of the SEAL team involved in the raid were killed when their chopper was shot down in Afghanistan a few months later, it was not implausible to suppose they might have been there by silence. Osama and Al-Qaeda, which was the name to give it to our base in Afghanistan, had nothing to do with 9/11. Osama denied he was involved in 9/11, implicating a government within the government. Another prominent figure has acknowledged the existence of a government within the government is William Jefferson Clinton, who admitted that this is an entity over which he exercised no control. Research by experts at the Vancouver hearing 15 to 17 June 2012 has vindicated his claim, where U.S. neocons, with assistance from the Mossad and the complicity of the Pentagon, orchestrated 9/11. Meanwhile, here's a typical Israeli. You can see here the Hamas tunnels leading to under these buildings, the Twin Towers. Meanwhile, if you want to get the facts, check out American Nuked on 9/11, compliments of the CIA, the neocons, and the DOD, and the Mossad. Chris, your thoughts.
One thing to add, didn't the FBI, they never concluded that he had been responsible for 9/11, isn't that right? I mean, like, as far as I've been able to tell, am I correct in that still?
Yes, and of course he had nothing to do with it. He was just the scapegoat.
Without question, yeah. And much of what we had really seen as far as initial coverage of the actual situation was that there was Israeli dual citizens that were caught with radio jamming equipment on each of the bridges. Basically, between these two systems, they could take out any radios that are in between those things. And basically, that would probably explain what happened to the first responders and their radio equipment all mysteriously failing all at once, all at the same time, and these people being led to their imminent doom, in addition to many of the casualties that came from the events. We talked about the controlled demolitions of Towers 1, 2, and even Tower 7. So, like, in my opinion, this was nothing more than like a gold robbery that was foisted onto some sort of a national act of terror, where basically the forces that were supposed to defend our country stood down or knew about it and basically had stand down orders from Cheney himself under the continuity of government program. So there's a lot of stuff that doesn't get mentioned in any of the official narratives. I remember they were going to have Kissinger look into who did this. And, he basically got laughed out of the room and booed out of the room, I should say. So you really got to look at this thing as far as the cui bono. You think about the Pentagon and the missing money, the $2.3 trillion that comes out on the day before this, right? This is when our entire budget deficit was like $1 trillion. Our national debt was $1 trillion at the time of 9/11. And think about $34 trillion and almost $7 trillion a year now to refinance every year moving forward with interest rates and things of the sort. So this is an amazing asset stripping operation that has been going on for the course of decades. And it all stems to this and from this. And I think a government within a government has absolutely taken over and has been in control, if not from 9/11, maybe much, much longer ago. The National Security Act of 47 basically legally justified these parallel organizations working and getting around the charters that they have. So, there's a lot of fishy stuff that's going on under the name of national security and patriotism and national defense. And I don't think it's really about defending the people. I think it's about securing this aristocracy and protecting their wealth from the people they stole it from.
Are you trying to tell me, Chris, that America is corrupt to the core?
Looking that way, brother. Looking at it like it was built to spill by design.
Wow.
Meanwhile, nightmare Thanksgiving report, it's Biden, a dirty secret, leaving America reeling. As we celebrate Thanksgiving, the White House wants you to know they've got your back. The Biden admin is bragging this year's dinner will be cheaper than 2022, when inflation made it the most expensive on record. But the White House shouldn't make that victory lap just yet, because the inflation brought on by Bidenomics continues to hurt working Americans. A new report come out that should put the admin to shame. Under Biden, more Americans are struggling. It's put a major strain on food banks, from Breitbart. The demand for local food banks is on the rise as soaring prices impact average Americans under Biden. The increasing demand for food banks demonstrates how soaring inflation driven by Bidenomics negatively impacts lower-income families. We are seeing unprecedented demand, Jackie DiCarlo, chief executive of Mana Food Center, told the Washington Post. Food bank demand rose dramatically in the last few months. The Biden admin might be claiming inflation is down, but prices are much higher than they were before Biden entered office. That resulted in a cumulative effort on the price of food. Working Americans and low-income families are struggling to afford the basics. Rent is increasing, as is the cost of gas and utilities. Even a modest increase in the cost of food harms many. As a result, demand for help from food banks, organizations providing food to the needy, has grown. The chief exec of Mana Food Center said, "We are seeing unprecedented demand. At one center, has provided food to 5,781 families in October, more than its monthly high during the pandemic. Food for Others has given out 30% more food this year than in 2022. Capital Area Food Bank, 31% more food since July. Because inflation is making food more expensive, some families have no choice but to rely on food banks or other charitable organizations. These are the same families who receive help from the federal government in the form of SNAP food stamps. Even with those taxpayer-funded handouts, many families find themselves unable to put food on the table. This isn't a third world country ravaged by war. This is the United States of America. Biden policies have appeared to benefit large corporations, foreign countries, illegal immigrants, and left-wing political groups, but not working Americans. Perhaps that's why 75% of respondents in a recent AP poll rated Biden's economy as poor. Key takeaways: demand for food banks has increased significantly under Biden. Rapid inflation due to his economic policies is making food expensive. Food bank operators said they are seeing unprecedented demands. Meanwhile, John McLaughlin to Newsmax: no one can catch Trump in the primaries. Former President Trump and President Biden appear to have smooth sailing to their party 2024 nominations. And should they face each other again, Trump will win. Pollster John McLaughlin told Newsmax. In our latest national poll of primary voters, we have Trump now at 58%. But we have DeSantis at only 11, Haley at 8, Ramaswamy also at 8. Actually, he's a little bit ahead of her. McLaughlin is polling for a more Trump campaign, told Eric Bowling, The Balance, and guest host Joe Pinion. One-on-one, Trump is crushing DeSantis, 75 to 25. They have no place to go. He said their poll showed Trump with a 49 to 43 lead as of Wednesday in head-to-head matchup with Biden. That's a poll with more 2020 Biden voters, because it's modeled after the 2020 election than Trump voters, and we're ahead. There's a Biden 2020 voters now voting for Donald Trump in 24. He said Democrats are panicking. But the only other primary challengers of Biden, Dean Phillips of Minnesota, and author and spiritual guru Marianne Williamson, can't catch him because he has a lock on their parties. he's got the delegate, McLaughlin said. He's the only one filing in these primary races from South Carolina on. He's going to crush Dean Phillips, who gets 3% of the vote. So it's going to be Trump, Biden again, and Trump will win. Chris, your thoughts.
Here, sorry. Hey. Sorry, I was muted. The two things I'd like to point out is that inflation and taxation are the means by which they will strip every one of their assets. They will turn working men and righteous people into beggars for what should be righteously theirs. This is absolutely part of the supply side economic control mechanism that they have put on with the Federal Reserve and the central banks after World War II. If you control the money supply, you can control the valuations. You can control the corporate socialism. So you have these runaway valuations for like Bang's companies or Walmart's or Amazon's or, you know, running mom and pop shops out of town and you know, the family farms off of solvency or things like that. Think about them subsidizing, you know, the big agricultural companies for as long as they have. Think about all these agricultural companies producing the poisons and the cancers that they do. And the doctors are baffled. The congressmen are certainly not aware of it. They don't know what's going on, and nobody seems to address these issues. You know, there's a good dozen soft kills you could point out in just your daily life that have superseded the regulatory agencies of our government via corruption, not an accident. And I think really when you get to the root of all these people, they have one thing in common, that they serve the Zionist interests over the United States. And I think that's becoming apparently evident in the past few years. And I think that it's ultimately going to come down to, you know, not only being in an America First situation, but really dealing with this parasite problem that we seem to have, because it's not going to go away. It's just going to move to other countries. They're going to create the Kohong debt slave system in China. They're going to run the Raj thing in India, you know, under pretenses that they have, you know, political distractions or whatever. Until we really deal with the root of evil and the root of this cause of such an asset stripping and dispossession and tactics, and certainly the health issues that we're facing, and certainly the genocidal things that have come from the health offerings in terms of the COVID shot and the vax and the Nuremberg stuff, we really need to have a moment of reckoning in this country. And I don't see anybody in the field of candidates that you mentioned there that are not subservient to Israel. There is one person that I have been listening to a little bit, a guy named Shiva Ayyadurai, who seems to make a lot of good points about this control and the Zionists and doing what they're doing, saying the right thing at the right time and standing up for principle. So I think ultimately we're going to have to really build something from the ground up, from the bottom up. And whether Trump can be a guy to lead us in that or not will remain to be seen. But I think he's really got to sever some ties with his previous affiliations if he's going to commit to something like that.
Nice point. Yeah, Don, you want to add?
Yeah, last time I questioned about our corruption here, Chris, and looking at it today and what you just said, is there a path forward? And how do we get a country back? And is there anything worth saving? I mean, looks like we're corrupt to the roots.
Oh, you're right, Don. We will take some sort of a radical localism where, you know, we're going to have to start from the community level and work our way up. You know, people leading the right thing, doing the right thing, getting clean water, clean food, livable wages, things like this are huge. Just getting the woke system out of our schools is massive. This is a major social engineering program that is being exposed. And I think really, once we break away from these conditionings that they've imposed on us and our children and really start to rethink our conventional reflexes, I think that's a good place to start and a good place to move forward.
Thank you.
Very nice.
There is hope, right?
Meanwhile, RFK Jr. on the JFK assassination. As a nation marked the 60th year since the assassination of John F. Kennedy, his nephew and independent presidential candidate, RFK Jr., blasted the Biden admin for refusing and being afraid to release all relevant government records. He, an independent candidate for the presidency, had called on the release of all documents about the assassination of his uncle, former President John F. Kennedy, on the 60th anniversary of the gruesome event. He announced the launch of a petition urging President Biden to fulfill his commitment to publicly disclose all documents related to the assassination. The President John F. Kennedy Assassination Record Collection Act of 1992 mandates that these documents be eventually disclosed to the public, barring any national security risk. The initial decline deadline for this disclosure was set at October 2017. Former President Trump released 2,800 of the 3,100 classified docs related to the assassination, citing national security concerns. Later, Biden issued a memorandum in 2021 for an intensive one-year review of the redactions, directing the National Archive to complete the review by May 1st, 2023. Any docs requested for non-disclosure beyond June 30th, 2023 would be subject to minimal limitations. As the petition explains, the 1993 Kennedy Record Assassination Act mandated the release of all records related to the assassination by 2017. Trump refused to do it. Biden refused to do it. RFK Jr. asked, "What's so embarrassing they're afraid to show the American public 60 years later?" The statement further highlights the low-trusting government advocating for the release of a full unredacted historical record to restore public trust. Trust in government is at an all-time low. Releasing the full unredacted historical record will help to restore that trust. In the spirit of transparency, in the spirit of democracy, the RFK Jr. campaign asks Americans to call upon President Biden to obey the 1992 Act and release the Kennedy assassination documents to the public. Robert Kennedy Jr. was just 9 years old when his uncle was assassinated during a campaign event in Dallas. JFK died instantly from a bullet wound to the head while seated in a limousine beside his wife, former First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy. Meanwhile, the Barnes Review's website, the Barnes Review History Hour, Dr. Jim Fetzer on JFK assassination, an 88-minute specific and detailed review of what happened on Elm Street in Dallas on 22 November 1963. Here are the answers to the who, the how, and the why of JFK. Meanwhile, Lauren Gunnow, Kennedy assassination, see how he did it, theorists are covering for Israel. Find this on my blog. Editor's note. After 30 years of collaborative research with the best qualified expert to ever study the case, I remain open to alternative interpretations. Here's my best framework for understanding JFK. Namely, you distinguish between the sponsors, the individuals and group who wanted him out, principally because they preferred the policies of LBJ, the mechanics, the shooters or supervisors and coordinators on the ground who included George H.W. Bush and Edward Lansdale, and the facilitators, Clinton of the assassination, J. Edgar Hoover of the cover-up. I have added some of my presentations here for alternative takes in comparison with the argument presented, including James Fetzer on JFK's assassination cover-up and JFK at 60, Mintz Conference, but where the sponsors included the CIA, the Joint Chiefs, the anti-Castro Cubans, the Mafia, the Eastern establishment surrounding the Fed, the Texas oilmen, Israel, and Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was the mastermind of the event. Meanwhile, Jeremy Kutzmeroff, Covert Action Magazine, publishes, 60 years after JFK's death, it is more and more apparent that Kennedy was a victim of a palace coup spearheaded by Vice President Johnson. Check him out at my blog. Chris, your thoughts?
Yeah, I definitely think there's a lot of moving pieces in this assassination, more than certainly the official narrative accounts for, without question. And as people like yourself and others have researched and found out, There was, you know, between six or possibly eight shooters that were in Dealey. There's probably all of them sponsored or put forth by a different entity, a departmentalized force in this. There's certainly, like you said, the people that were mentioned, and probably more so. There was people involved with this that were on an innocuous level, operatives that have no idea what they were probably even doing or were so departmentalized. It was just one facet of a big picture. But to tie all this stuff together, it takes immense organization, immense amount of money, and basically everybody just in this blood oath in the way that they are. So, you know, they're waist deep in the blood of the innocent there. And certainly I think there was probably a challenge to much of their organizational power. You know, creating a lot of headaches for people that maybe shouldn't and didn't want to have their operations exposed. You can get into the mafia and what, you know, RFK was doing, you know, the Valachi papers coming out at the time. For the longest time, the FBI didn't even admit there was the presence of a mafia. You know, J. Edgar Hoover, a 32nd degree Mason, is running around talking about conspiracy so large that, you know, you wouldn't know who's involved with it and don't even dare mention it. You know, Winston Churchill talks about the same thing. Woodrow Wilson, you know, JFK talks about this group trying to enslave all of humanity. You know, a couple weeks later, he's killed. You know, this is a statement I think they sent to by the nature of his killing, the head wound and stopping the limo and making him a sitting duck like that was kind of, I think, an unspoken message for any other future idealist, too. And the fact that these guys have gotten away with it for as long as they have without even having a finger pointed at them reminds me of a situation we're facing currently with people doing this to everyone now and murdering, you know, and putting this depopulation ethnic cleansing program on worldwide. And you can't even point a finger at these guys without being deplatformed or even thrown in jail in some states or countries. So I think, yeah, this is a big problem when you face an enemy from within and you can't even name the enemy. Or you are persecuted. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of high power in some real dark places that have exercised their grip on this. And I think you guys have done a great job as far as presenting who the potential and likely culprits were behind this. You know, you can really see what they've done with this breakaway government ever since then and what they're continuing to do. So I think that really it's an all-hands-on-deck mission, not only to solve this murder, but to really get behind much of the deceptions that we have been victimized by and have this political and economic capital foisted upon us from. So until we really come to that reckoning and summon the fortitude and diligence to figure these things out, I think these guys are just going to be, you know, spinning us in circles with these parlor tricks. So good on you and everyone that's really standing up for the truth here. And I think it's a fucking shame that they're not giving RFK Secret Service protection too in this point, you know, given what he's gone through as well. So yeah, this is I'll leave it to you guys. Yeah. I'm just rambling at this point.
No, that's a great point, because I mean, this is an obvious invitation to assassinate Bobby Jr. How can you not give him there's never been a presidential candidate since Jack that didn't have Secret Service protection, except now today the Biden admin to RFK Jr. How offensive is that? How outrageous, how culpable, how disgusting. You're 100% correct, Chris. It's like they're inviting his assassination.
They're daring him to try to change, you know, make a change. You know, all right, let's do something substantial versus let's toe the official narrative line or be a controlled opposition. And I think that's really presenting him from really exercising that ability to do what his conscience would tell him to do.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. Meanwhile, key assassination doctors break their silence to key government claims. They've emphasized there was a small entry wound to the throat and a major blowout at the back of the head. I can go further. Here, of course, is the official narrative. Three shots from the sixth floor of the Book Depository building were the Secret Service and the FBI that very day concluded there'd been three shots with three hits. And Jack had been hit in the back, about 5.5 inches below the shoulder, just to the right of the spinal column, a shallow shot that only went in about as far as a second knuckle on your little finger. That Connolly had been hit in the back, and that Jack had been hit in the back of the head, killing him. When this was revealed, however, Many may have recalled that when Malcolm Kilduff announced his death, he pointed to his right temple and said it was a simple matter of a bullet right through the head, clearly not one that had been fired from above and behind. Meanwhile, that very day, that very afternoon, the live reporting on radio and television was very thorough and detailed about the president having suffered two hits. One was a small, clean puncture wound to the throat with no point of exit from Malcolm Berry, M.D., who performed a simple tracheostomy incision through the wound, described it three times during the Parkland press conference held after Malcolm Kilduff announced the president's death, that it was a wound of entry that the bullet was coming at him. In addition, he explained the bullet that entered the right temple and blew out the back of his head, taking half his brains with it, attributed to Admiral George Berkeley, the president's personal physician. These two wounds, shots both of which had been fired from in front, were reported in detail and repetitiously during the day. Later in the evening, when the stories became to trickle in, yet behind the Secret Service had concluded there had been three shots, all of which had been fired from above and behind, Frank McGee, who is nobody's fool, says, "This is incongruous. How can the man have been shot from in front, from behind?" Meanwhile, if you put together the two shots to the throat and to the right temple that were reported that day with two shots that the government was reporting, a shot to the back and a shot to the back of the head killing him, you get four or five hits that JFK sustained that day, where David W. Manick, M.D., who's the world's leading expert on the head wounds, believes there was a third shot to the head from the side at about the very same time he was hit in the right temple. The mortician who prepared the body for burial told an investigator, in addition to a large gaping hole in the back of the head, there was a small wound in the right temple and a wound to the back, 5 to 6 inches below the shoulder to the right of the spinal column. He also mentioned a skull flap, which was 3 inches, that was still attached to the head, that appears to have been blown open by that shot to the side of the head. Also, that were two small shrapnel wounds to the face that were leaking embalming fluid, and he had to pack with wax, which David Mantic has inferred that because the bullet that hit him through the throat passed through the windshield were caused by tiny shards of glass that were released when a bullet passed through. Notice he also had adrenaline glands and brain removed, other organ removed but then put back. No swelling or discoloration to the face, meaning JFK died instantly. Here you have a small, clean puncture wound to the throat. This is a diagram from Charles Crenshaw. I was in trauma room number one. When I was editing my very first book, Collection of Expert Studies, Assassination Science, which would be published in 1998, I invited him to provide me with drawings of the wounds, both before and after the tracheostomy. Notice it was a simple, clean incision through that small, clean puncture wound. It would turn out at Bethesda, however, the wound would be greatly increased to resemble something that looked like an exit wound. By the way, I do not believe this is JFK's body. Charles Crenshaw explained to me that when he assisted wrapping the body in sheets and placing it into the bronze ceremonial casket, he closed JFK's eyes. In addition, autopsy photographs showed his face to be completely intact, even though in the Zapruder film, there's what looks like a blob emerging from the right forehead. Even skeptics had to agree And either the Zapruder film or the autopsy photographs, or both, have to be forgeries. From the 1970s, Lifton had argued that the bright reddish white wound that seemed to appear and snake up the side of the president's head, which he called the blob, completely disagreed with the description of the head wound given by the doctors and nurses at Dallas Parkland Hospital, where the president was taken. Here is a diagram of the blowout at the back of the head, the size of your fist when you double it up, approved by Dr. Robert McClellan from Parkland. Here are Charles Crenshaw's diagrams of the same wound from the side and from the back. David Mantic entered the National Archives for the first time in late 1992. Before he went in, he and I had a conversation during which he told me he thought he would find evidence of a second shot to the head. Heretofore, there had only been one that had been acknowledged from the back of the head, and that he would find proof that the autopsy x-rays had been altered. He discovered both. Notice here, using a technique known as optical densitometry from physics, which enables you to measure the relative density of the objects whose exposure to x-rays created the image, he discovered this area P for patch was much too dense to be human bone, so that unless the back of JFK's head was nothing but solid bone, unless, in other words, he was a bonehead, it was not a naturally occurring phenomenon. It had occurred to me that while they blacked out the blowout to the back of the head in early frames, 3, 14, 15, 16, 17, that he might have overlooked that it would be visible in later frames. And here in frame 374, I found it. You see, the wound here, bluish gray, remember how brain matter is often called gray matter. The pink is that skull flap described by the physician, the mortician who prepared the body for funeral. Here you can see earlier, this is like 312. This is after where you see the blob here, and the blowout at the back of the head has been blacked out, done in a highly amateurish manner compared to what's visible in frame 374. When I compared it with David's area P, you can see there's a very close approximation, except that Jack's hairline, his hair extrudes into the wound, so it's not quite a perfect match, but it's very close. They appear like a cashew on its side. Meanwhile, when the House Select Committee on Assassinations reinvestigated the case in 1977-78, its medical panel concluded the entry wound, and by this they mean that shot to the back of the head, which was like in the vicinity where I have the cursor of the external occipital protuberance, had actually been 4 inches higher at the crown of the head. But in photographs, you can't see it, only in diagrams. And here, of course, again, you see the skull flap, and that's because this appears to be completely made up. Moreover, it's not even consistent with a harbor fragment. Saturday afternoon, 23 November, 1963, a medical student named Billy Harper found a fragment of skull bone on the grass opposite the grassy knoll. He took it to his uncle, Jack Harper, M.D., on the staff at Methodist Hospital, who shared it with a chief pathologist, A.B. Carnes. He and three others identified it as occipital bone from the back of a human cranium. They took photographs of this piece of bone, which is known as the Harper fragment, before turning it over to the FBI, which was a good thing, because, like other evidence in this case, it was misplaced. David Mantic had identified the location on the back of the president's skull from which it was blown out as Murder in Dealey Plaza 2000, a second of my three early trilogy, has explained. Not all of the evidence in this case was altered, fabricated, or otherwise fake. Some of it was simply lost. Thus, we have three different depictions of the back of the head wound suffered by JFK. On the one hand, at Parkland, you have the fist side blowout at doctors have diagrammed. At Bethesda, the wound was greatly enlarged. It's described in mathematical detail in the Bethesda autopsy report. This is no fantasy. Commander Humes took a cranial saw to the skull of JFK and greatly enlarged the wound, so it appeared to be something that could have been the result of a rifle shot had JFK been leaned far forward. Unfortunately, he did that in front of Thomas Evan Robinson, the mortician, whose description of the body we have reviewed, who spent more time with it in preparation for the funeral than any other person. And then on the right, you have the fantasy reconstruction of the House Select Committee on Assassinations when it published its final report in 1979, apparently wanting to redo the cover-up better at that late date. But here you see a host of witnesses from Dealey Plaza, for example, Beverly Oliver, Phil Willis, Marilyn Willis, Ed Hoffman, from Parkland Hospital, Dr. McCormick, Dr. Peters, Dr. Sellier, Dr. Carrico, Dr. Delaney, Dr. Carrico, Dr. Jones, Nurse Bell, Theron Ward, who is a justice of the peace, who tried to keep the Secret Service from stealing the body because an autopsy was required by law to be conducted in Dallas County. Then you have the ambulance driver, Audrey Reich, from the autopsy, Frank O'Neill, and Gerald Custer, the autopsy technician who took the x-rays of Bethesda, Paul O'Connor, Floyd Reby, who assisted there. Meanwhile, David Mantic, board certified in radiation oncology, which is a treatment of cancer using x-ray therapy, took a CAT scan of a patient with chest and neck dimensions similar to those at JFK. When he plotted the official trajectory, it turned out to be anatomically impossible because cervical vertebrae intervened. If you want more, check out the fourth of my books, the third having been The Great Zapruder Film Hoax, published in 2003. Now, the sequel, JFK, Who, How, and Why, Solving the World's Greatest Murder Mystery, published in 2017. Chris, your thoughts?
Yeah, can you buy your books on Amazon, or are they still banning you on there?
You can buy the 9/11 and the JFK books both on Amazon still, or at moonrockbooks.com.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's amazing to see how many of these little pieces and how this has been departmentalized. I use that word a lot, but it's important to think about this. How many of these people, the witnesses that have come up missing or had some sense of foul play, think about all the operators that have been involved in here, the usual suspects and their incongruencies. Think about just putting a ballistics report of not only Kennedy, but then Connolly as well. And then the stray bullets that were found in, you know, whether it's the curb or in a windshield of the limo or wherever, in the bed of a stretcher or in someone else days later or whatever. There's so many incongruencies in there. And the way that they all have tied together so nicely in the official narrative and the usual suspects behind that and the Warren Commission. Look at their histories. Look at Earl Warren running concentration camps as the governor of California in World War II for first-generation German and Japanese citizens. Think about, basically everyone except Hale Boggs, who they took his plane down, was pretty much in on this. And I think that maybe to some extent they thought he would be in on this. And I think he vocalized some incongruencies, too, that may have led to his early and untimely demise. This whole thing, Rubenstein, you know, Jack Ruby and his connections, not only to the Jewish mafia, but to the Italian mafia and his, you know, cleanup of that whole assassin and the Oswald thing. Oswald's background, FBI, CIA, Office of Naval Intelligence. Man, there is just so many things that just scream bloody murder. Like you said the other day, Fetz, with them stopping the limo for as long as they did and figuring that out. This was a flat out sacrifice, a turkey shoot. And the conspirators to this day have gotten away with it. And you see what they put in place instead of our actual constitutional government. And I think this is a big, big step in history. This was your generation's 9/11, in my opinion. And I think it's important to get to the bottom of this. And certainly look at the RFK one, too, with the ballistics report and that. 13 bullets found, and Sirhan's gun holds 8 bullets. So, you know, this is just an absolute farce. And the FBI is without doubt complicit in the cover-up, and the law enforcement agencies too. This is bad news, and this is our own military that has executed our chief executive officer in public, and almost has done it twice with RFK, because he was going to win in 68.
Just add a few additional observations. We had a succession of presidents who would have never occupied the office but for the death of JFK. In fact, they were very worried about a Kennedy dynasty, that Jack would serve 2 terms and Bobby would serve 2 terms and Teddy would serve 2 terms. They wanted to cut it off at the start. Lyndon Johnson, of course, who was actually the mastermind, the whole event originated in Los Angeles in 1960 when Jack beat Lyndon for the nomination of the Democratic Party. He invited Stuart Symington, a senator from Missouri, to be his running mate, but gave him overnight to think about it. Bobby went by the Johnson suite to extend a pro forma symbolic invitation to run with Jack, never imagining he'd have the least interest. Lyndon jumped on it, threatening to expose that Jack had Addison's disease and wasn't expected to live a long, healthy life. And among his dalliances was one with a beautiful woman who was a spy for East Germany, information he'd been provided by Edgar, and that if he were not on the ticket, then his position as a powerful majority leader of the Senate, he'd bottle up any legislative proposals coming down from the White House, which would be dead on arrival. Bobby and Jack were flummoxed, tried to figure a way out, but Lyndon had them boxed in, and they had to accede to his demand. When one of Johnson's wealthy backers learned LBJ would be on the ticket, he burst into the Johnson suite cursing and swearing, because now Lyndon would help JFK become president. Bobby Baker took him into a bedroom and explained what they had in mind. He came out all smiles, saying he thought that was an excellent plan. Bobby Baker would later declare in public that JFK would not survive his first term and that he would die a violent death. At the time, when it came, Lyndon sent Cliff Carter, his chief administrative assistant, down to Dallas to make sure all the pieces were in place, all the arrangements were made for the assassination. Regarding Bobby, you're absolutely right. Bobby was shot behind the right ear from a distance of 1.5 inches by the security guard accompanying him, who had a revolver of the same make and model as Sirhan. Sirhan's function was distraction to fire all those bullets, where Sirhan had been under psychiatric care induced by hypnosis to react as he did, almost certainly triggered by a girl in a polka dot dress, while the security guard, after shooting Bobby behind the ear, continued to fire as Bobby fell, where he grabbed his tie. He hit him twice more in the body and once through his jacket. And somewhere you can see him dying on the pantry floor. You can see the tie clasp from Thane Eugene Caesar, who is the actual assassin. And nevertheless, when an autopsy was conducted by Thomas Noguchi, who was a world-famous medical examiner, and related how Bobby had actually died, it was in conflict with a police report. And believe it or not, Noguchi was fired. The LAPD was so powerful at the time that even though he had it exactly right, politics prevailed over forensic science, and for good reason. I actually believe Israel had a larger role to play in the assassination of Bobby than it in the case of Jack. There were 8 different shooters, one for each of those sponsors. Israel had 1 of the 8. While the argument could be made, they exerted greater influence through other of the sponsors. I do not believe Israel alone was responsible for the death of JFK. And even though it does appear that Johnson had a Jewish grandmother, whatever, the case to be made, in my opinion, is overwhelming that LBJ was a mastermind. Go to my blog and look at the 2 of the last 3 blogs and you'll see what I'm talking about, where I embedded 4 of my summaries, a distillation of 30 years of research on JFK in those presentations, embedded within an article about the role of Israel in the assassination, and make a judgment for yourself. Chris, a final thought.
Yeah, didn't LBJ immediately enter us into the Vietnam War, and as well as also in the Middle East conflict, the precursor to the Arab-Israeli War of 67, and the Yom Kippur one, the next, you know, the Liberty thing, all that stuff too. The Gulf of Tonkin, Morrison, Admiral Morrison there. You know, LBJ was definitely a prima facie benefactor of that without question. He had to have been in on it. He got on the ticket mysteriously, you know, very, very mysteriously, kind of like George Bush did on the Reagan ticket in 1980. And they almost got him in the Tecumseh curse there when it was broken. But yeah, that was some definite shenanigans. You remember Reagan was talking about auditing West Point and the Fed and the gold supply. He's been talking since like 56 was the last audit they had there. And he was basically campaigning on one of that as his major notions. So I think that really the bankers sent a message to him too, in the same way they did with JFK. He was going to remonetize silver. And they wanted to demonetize it, which is LBJ did that straight away too in 64. So there's a lot of stuff that doesn't get mentioned by the official narrative or like put into context with this. But when you see all these things and they all add up, it really creates a much different picture than the official narrative. And it really lines up with what you are saying and many other people have been saying about this. And I'm just glad that people are out there fighting for the truth, because it is important. And you know, it will ultimately lead to either justice or full out, you know, in slavery and oppression. So really what we do here and with this and what we do with 9/11 and moving forward are crucial to not only our own character, but to the future of our children. So I'm glad people like yourself are out there, Fetz, fighting the good fight and standing up for the truth. And I'm glad they haven't got us yet.
You make a nice point about Ronald Reagan. John Hinckley did not shoot Reagan. He was shot by a Secret Service agent using a flechette under the armpit when he pushed him into the presidential limousine, barely missing his heart. But he got the message, let George do it. And thereafter, his vice president, George Herbert Walker Bush, was essentially running the government.
So the war on drugs,
So with Jack out, we had Lyndon Johnson president. He could have ensured Hubert Humphrey would have succeeded them, but he delayed campaigning to the last 2 weeks and it was too late. So we had Richard Nixon because he wanted another co-conspirator. Nixon had been at the ratification meeting at the home of Clint Murchison Sr. the night before. Then Gerald Ford, who'd been Hoover's man on the commission, informing him of the direction it was going. Jimmy Carter was an accidental president. And when we had Ronald Reagan, it turns out they were able to get George H.W. Bush, who'd actually been a supervisor in Dallas and who had orchestrated the Bay of Pigs invasion, into power with that shot on Reagan. And had it not been for G.H.W. Bush's service as president, no one, I think, would have ever taken W seriously for that role. So he had a whole succession. The course of American history thereby changed. Chris, excellent comments. Don, take us out.
Oh, wow. What a show this has been on November 26th. And I think this one is one that you want to save and archive and send out. I mean, where else can you get Scott? And although everything that we did is remarkable and nobody else is doing, and you want to make sure that you get this out to the world here. And I thank you so much for Jim and Chris and everybody here. This is just amazing. I feel blessed, and you can be blessed too by sharing this with other people. I know you're doing good and realizing that this country has been corrupted way even before 1963. And hopefully it was going to be able to be saved. But right now, it looks like we have a lot of things to cure and to make it right. And I don't know if the election is going to do it or whatever, but hopefully we'll get that back on a right course and stop corruption. But it's something else. And I really thank you for watching. God bless. Hope to see you next week.